Hey there, welcome to the Niche Optimizer Formula audio tutorial. It's great to have you here. I'm glad you've decided to invest in this training program. You know, one of the biggest sources of pain and anxiety for both new and even established freelance writers is deciding on a niche. And for new or aspiring freelancers, what I've found is this niche quest, so to speak, tends to create a lot of confusion. It stalls progress, it kills momentum. In fact, I've seen this decision kill more dreams than just about anything else during this early phase of the business launch. And the reason is, at least I believe, is that new freelancers think that they have to make a final decision on this issue before they go to market. And that's simply not true. Now, don't get me wrong, having a niche or a specific target market is definitely a good idea, but it's not a prerequisite for launching your commercial writing business. Now, for those who have been freelancing for a while, the challenge is a little different. They're typically so close to their business, their freelance business, that they've developed a blind spot of sorts, and the options aren't very clear. And then the ideal scenario is often not even on their radar screen. So in this tutorial and the accompanying workbook, I'm going to give you a simple framework for determining if you should define a niche and how to find one that makes sense, and then what to do if you can't come up with anything viable. One quick tip before we get started, I would print or have the accompanying workbook available with you and in front of you as you listen to the audio tutorial. It's going to help you see this better and retain the material better, and you'll be able to reference the illustrations that I talk about in the tutorial. Now, you really can't have a productive discussion about picking a niche without taking account positioning, this issue of positioning. In fact, I think positioning is what truly frames the whole niche discussion. I really believe that talking about finding a niche is in many ways counterproductive, because more important is having a discussion about how you're going to position yourself in the market. So we're going to use positioning as our guide for making this important decision. The term positioning gets thrown quite a bit these days, and it tends to create a lot of confusion. It sounds like the kind of term you normally hear used in corporate marketing environments. So let's define it. What's this about? What's positioning? Well, positioning is about the perception you create in the prospect's mind. It's the perception that your prospect has about you and your services when they come in contact with your marketing materials or with your website or even with you in a conversation. It's also about our uniqueness, you know, your difference, what makes you different from most others, and why a prospect should care about that difference. A good way to start this positioning discussion is to talk about how three different companies position themselves, because in reality, there's not that much difference between how a company creates perception and how you and I can do the same as freelance writers. And sure, the scale is greater with a big company, but the principles are still the same. So let's start with the Ritz-Carlton Hotels. Ritz-Carlton is obsessed about every single detail about the consumer and the consumer's needs, their wants, their expectations. Everything they do is about delighting their guests. In their mind, they don't sell hotel rooms. They're selling a memory. They're selling an unforgettable experience. And one of the ways they do this is through unsurpassed service to every guest, every single time, no exceptions. They even have, if you go to their website, I haven't been there in a while, but the last time I checked, they even detail there's three steps of service. And I found that most companies overlook this. And the three steps are very simple. Number one, deliver a warm and sincere greeting and use the guest's name every possible time. Number two, anticipate and fulfill the needs of each guest. And number three, give a warm goodbye, again, using the guest's name. And the Ritz-Carlton believes that guest recognition is a top priority. Now, this sounds simple. It sounds non-revolutionary. It sounds, you know, kind of like the lip service you typically hear from a lot of these bigger companies. But the difference is obvious the moment you set foot in their hotels. My wife and I have stayed at a Ritz-Carlton property two or three times in the past. And I tell you, you can tell immediately the moment you set foot in that place, everything about what they do is different, is top-notch. first class. They truly care. They have been trained to care. Everyone from the doorman to the person at the checkout counter to room service to, you know, just everything in the hotel is set up based on creating that kind of memory and creating that kind of experience for every single guest. They're very clear about who they are. They're very clear about how they serve their guests and what makes them different. And they're not trying to please everyone. You know, and that's a very important point here. They're just trying to serve a small segment of travelers who really respond to this, who really care about this. And that's very, very important. So they're not trying to be all things to all people. That's a common thread you'll see throughout these examples and as you work through your own exercises a little bit later. Let's take a look at another example. This time, Trader Joe's, the grocery chain in the U.S. I believe they're only in the U.S. I don't think they're in Canada. But Trader Joe's is one of the most profitable grocers in the world. It's quite remarkable. They actually have twice the sales per square foot of the average grocery store in the United States. It's extremely profitable. And how do they do this? Well, there are many different parts to their formula, but one is they have innovative, hard-to-find, great-tasting foods at excellent prices. They offer real value to their customers, and value is a concept they take very seriously. And by value, I'm talking about great everyday prices on all their products. They don't have sales. They don't have gimmicks. There's no clubs to join, no special cards you need to swipe in order to save on certain items, nothing like that. And they can do this because they create their own products directly with contract manufacturers. So they cut out the middleman and direct every aspect of the product's recipe and quality. I believe 80% of their products are their own branded products. They keep only their best performing products. You know, they keep a very close eye on what's moving, which keeps their assortment manageable, their inventory low, their prices low, and their customers really happy. The first time they opened where I live in the Atlanta area, I was not impressed when I set foot in there. I was expecting a little bit more glitz. I thought it would look more like a Whole Foods in a smaller scale, but it wasn't long before I understood what these guys are all about. Trader Joe's is all about amazing products at great prices. You see a lot of cooks, home cooks in their stores, people who know food. They cook quite frequently. They understand the value of using quality ingredients. And they're there. They're shopping. They're getting a lot of their ingredients there. You're not going to find people who want the absolute cheapest food in town. Instead, what you're going to find are savvy consumers who want high quality at a really good price. And if you've ever shopped at a Trader Joe's, you have to agree that they absolutely meet that promise. Let's look at a final example, Walmart, which is the world's largest retailer. So what's Walmart all about? Well, their motto says it all: save money, live better. It's all about everyday low prices. In fact, they pride themselves in being the absolute lowest cost retailer. They will never be undersold. They pride themselves in convenience in terms of locations. I mean, you can find them just about anywhere in the U.S., even in remote areas. They have a huge assortment of products. This is really the place to go when you need something and you're not really sure where to go. Walmart's going to have it. You know, you're not going to risk it. If you make a trip to a Walmart, they're probably going to have what you need, and they're probably going to have it at the cheapest price possible. So you don't risk overpaying if you go there. Now, what don't you get? You don't really get high customer service. You don't get easy in and out. You don't get a memorable shopping experience, right? So you trade the convenience of the huge assortment and the absolute rock bottom prices for a lack of customer service. It's not easy to kind of navigate through the store. These stores are now huge, they're massive. These super Walmarts are just, I forget what the average square footage is, but it's very difficult to go in there. It's not an easy in and out. If you're going in there, it's going to be a while before you get out the door. Now, none of these businesses is better than the other. And this is not about that. My point is that each of these companies has done an amazing job of positioning themselves for huge success. And they've done that because they're crystal clear about who they are, what they do, whom they serve, and what makes them different. They don't try to be all things to all people. Instead, they take pride in serving a specific segment of the market or meeting a very specific need. Now, it doesn't matter if you're a retailer, a hotel chain, a bookstore, a day spa, or even a freelance writer. If you're in business, nothing matters until you've clearly identified and communicated your positioning. And I say that because a natural tendency with freelancers and with many small business owners is to get the positioning thing out of the way as quickly as possible so they can begin selling. You know, we all want clients as quickly as possible. We want better clients. And we think that if we just hang our shingle and put up our website or make some very simple, superficial changes, clients will come. You know, that they'll be wowed by our experience or credentials or samples and our beautiful website design, that sort of thing. And that's not the case. The fact is that the world does not need another freelance commercial writer. What the world really needs are freelance commercial writers who are clear about their positioning. That way, prospects can make better decisions faster and they can spend less time finding the right person, and then we as freelancers can spend less time selling and more time on billable work. So think about it. As a business owner, your time is your most valuable non-renewable resource, right? And because you're limited by your time, you cannot afford to spend too much time and energy selling prospects. Instead, you have to do as much pre-selling as possible through clear and compelling positioning, which often occurs through your website. That way, when prospects inquire into your services, into your business, they're already pre-sold to a certain extent. And you don't have to do all the heavy lifting at that point in that initial conversation or that email exchange. We have a family friend in West Virginia who recently retired after managing Kroger grocery stores for over 30 years. And I was talking to him about product assortments in the stores, and mainly because I had been writing a series of white papers for a client of mine, a freelance writing client of mine, who sells to grocery chains. They sell software that manages their distribution centers and their inventory and their supply chain. So I was very interested in that topic, and we struck a conversation and we started talking a little bit about the business of running grocery stores. And I asked them if they carried Boar's Head brand deli meats in their stores, which is pretty much the standard brand where I live in the metro Atlanta area. And he explained that there's no way that they could make that work in the West Virginia stores that he managed. Now, if you're not familiar with the Boar's Head brand, they are typically 30% or more, and I'm just guessing, but I would guess about 30% or more higher in price than the mainstream brands. Now, that works in the suburbs of Atlanta, which are fairly affluent compared to many parts of the country. You know, people here seek that kind of quality. They have the incomes to support it. But in rural West Virginia, Boar's Head products would not sell, according to my friend. And the income levels, he explained, just don't support that kind of premium. His customers are not pre-sold on the brand, in other words. So trying to sell the advantages of that product right there at the deli counter would be pointless. Can you imagine, you know, how frustrating and unprofitable it would be if the people at the deli counter tried to sell everyone on paying 30% more for this other brand of deli meat or cheese? It would be very difficult. And it's the same thing with a freelance writing business. So trying to convert the unconvertible, if you will, is a dangerous strategy. It's unprofitable. It's frustrating. It's really a game that has no winner. This idea makes sense to people when I explain it this way, right? You're probably nodding your head right now. Typically when I explain this idea in a live presentation, I see a lot of heads nodding when I teach a concept. But when you look at freelance writer websites, you see something very different. You know, it's usually a combination of two or more of these core ideas. My words will help you do blah, 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 blah. Or I'll write anything for anyone, anytime, for any budget. And I know that sounds extreme. I actually read that in somebody's website recently. I mean, they were pretty much saying that, almost those exact words. You also see things like, I'm a journalist, so I can do a better job than your average writer, blah, 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 something like that. Or let me tell you why you need strong copy. Let me tell you why you need a copywriter. Now, as a prospect looking for a writer, none of these ideas hook me on why you're uniquely positioned to help me solve my specific challenges. And that's why it's so important to give careful thought to your positioning. And that's what we're going to be focusing on for the rest of this training. Now, for our purposes, positioning is about defining what you do, for whom, why you're different, and why that difference matters to your prospects and to your clients. Your positioning should also include one or more credibility elements that answer the inevitable prospect question, okay, why should I believe or trust you? Usually those credibility elements are obvious when you describe the four elements that we just listed, but sometimes you have to state them outright. Also, for our purposes, your positioning will be written from the point of view of what you'll be offering your clients, which is not necessarily focused on what you've done in the past. So in other words, it's about what you're capable of delivering, not about what you've delivered or done in the past. So don't freak out if you don't have much experience with certain types of projects, or very little or no experience in certain types of projects, or if you think you'd like to take your business in a very different direction that interests you. What truly matters at this point is your overall track record and the experiences of your experience as a professional, not necessarily where you've focused on over the past few years. Now, something else I need to clarify is the language that I'll be using here and throughout this program. And probably the most common term used when talking about positioning is the word niche. We've been using that word so far, and I've been, I introduced the idea of positioning, but I've used the word niche as well. You read a lot about picking your niche and deciding on a niche or being clear about your niche. I don't mind that word at all. In fact, I use it quite frequently in my articles and my podcasts. I've used it here several times already. But for purposes going forward in this training, we're going to be using more specific terminology. And I'm going to try to stick to the following terms. There's two of them: target market and specialty. Target market refers to a group of prospects that you can best serve. There are many ways to slice that, one of the most common being industry, an industry that's your target market. However, and this is important, industry is not the only way to look at your target market. There are other attributes to consider, including other demographics or psychographics or common desires, needs, or challenges of a group of people or organizations. Also, for our purposes, the word specialty will refer to a type of assignment you've chosen to focus on, a type of project. For instance, white papers or bylined articles or web copy or book ghostwriting, that sort of thing. Again, there's no right or wrong here. You do not need to focus on a particular industry and you do not need to have a specialty, but you should have a well-defined target market if you want to accelerate your progress, if you want to improve your business and boost your income. And again, a target market is simply a group of prospects you can best serve. That's all it is. So here's why you need to define one or more target markets you want to pursue. It's a very simple statement, or really a question. Would you rather be a little fish in a big pond or a big fish in a little pond? Now, many freelancers avoid specificity when talking about their target market because they don't want to miss out on any potential work. But that's a myth. There's really more work out there than you and I could ever handle in a lifetime. And as counterintuitive as it sounds, it's better to narrow your target market and stake your claim. Because when you do that, the prospects that are a good fit for you will be much more committed. They'll be more pre-sold, and everything else being equal, they'll be much easier to work with. So in other words, you'll get more and better quality clients when you narrow your field a little bit than you would when you try to be all things to everyone. And here's a little secret. Just because you state your claim doesn't mean that you won't have variety in your clients and in your work. That's a common misconception. You'll still get a wide variety of work But you won't have to convince those clients to hire you. They're going to come ready to do that. And I'll give you an example from my own business. So for years, I was very clear on my website about whom I best served. And specifically, I was very focused on the enterprise software market. And most of my samples were software companies in the ERP, data management, and construction software markets or sectors within the software industry. However, I had several prospects from other industries come to me to write their white papers or other marketing materials. And they were either recommended by one of my clients or they stumbled on my website and saw something in my approach, in my style, that they found very attractive. The great thing about that scenario is that I was able to choose the clients and projects that sounded interesting. And I carefully selected the assignments I thought could do well. And that gave me the variety that I needed to keep my work interesting. In other words, the people that came to me who were outside of the target market that I was specific about on my website, I was able to be choosy because they were the ones pursuing me. And I was able to choose based on what I saw, based on who sounded interesting, based on how they sounded to me, and based on the subject matter. And that in itself added some variety to my work and what I did. One example of that was a division of Kaiser Permanente that sells employee wellness programs to Fortune 1000 companies. And their marketing director found me online and she pursued me to write some white papers for her because she really liked my work. She liked my style and she read some of my samples and she, you know, I explained to her that I just didn't know her industry. And I was ready to let this one go. But then she was very adamant about the fact that she didn't feel that was important. She felt that my ability to craft a compelling argument transcended this lack of industry background in her industry specifically. So she hired me for a white paper, and that led to another white paper and then some other miscellaneous projects. And it all worked really, really well. Okay, let's dissect each of these elements. In fact, that's where we're going to spend the rest of this session. And we're going to go through them in order, starting with the what you do and the for whom elements of your positioning. So what and for whom are the two factors that define your target market when you think about it, right? What refers to the type of writing or writing assignments you take on, and for whom refers to the types of clients for whom you do that work. So let's start with what, because this is the simplest element of your positioning. When it comes to defining your what, you want to look at factors such as type of assignments, copy versus content or both, short versus long copy or content, and any other assignment attributes you can think of. And we're going to go through an exercise later in the session that will help you pinpoint your ideal what. But for now, just know that you'll want to define this in your web copy and in prospect conversations. Your what doesn't need to be super specific. In other words, I write case studies. It can be much more general than that. All right, let's move on to the for whom part of your positioning. This for whom part tends to create much more anxiety than the what. So we're going to spend a lot more time on this one. And again, this is important because the days of just being a writer are gone. You know, at least if you want to earn a handsome income and if you want to have a much more balanced lifestyle. So as I mentioned earlier, this does not mean that you have to declare an industry niche. Picking a for whom does not mean you have to declare an industry niche. I think that bears repeating. It just means that you have to define a target market that's true to you and to your specific situation. To make the right decision, let me walk you through the four key factors to consider when deciding on your for whom. And again, we're going to go through a detailed exercise later in this program. So don't worry about trying to take down all this information or making a decision right now. Just for now, bear with me and let this sink in a little bit. And I think you'll be better prepared for the exercise than trying to take it all in and work through this, through the answers. There are four key factors to consider when making this decision, and it's important that you treat each of them with great care because you'll have to decide where you fall inside of each of these areas. The first one is your passions and talents. And by that, I'm talking about topics that you care about or you find interesting, personal and or business passions, fields where you already have a good amount of knowledge, you know, that sort of thing. Start there. And again, we're going to go through an exercise later that will help you define this better. But for now, just know that you'll want to take passions, interests, and knowledge into consideration when deciding on your target market. Next, the next area is who you know. And by that, I'm talking about who you already, where you already have relationships. You know, where are your contacts today, both personal and professional? How strong are these contacts? How many of them are good connectors? You know, by connectors, I'm talking about people who are really good at connecting people together. Why does this matter? Well, you want to know and would define who you know and where you know them, because relationships have never been this important as they are today. And very often, some of our best opportunities can come from those we know, even if we can't see it at the moment. In fact, one of the most pivotal moments of my career came as a result of a casual conversation I had with someone who I never imagined they could put me in contact with exactly the right people at the right time. It's the biggest reason I'm here today doing what I do. So don't discount the fact that, you know, maybe Ralph is completely outside of anything business related. There's no way he can help you. You never know. Everyone can be of potential help to you. And again, we're going to go through an exercise later that will help you see areas of your network that may have good potential. The next area is what I called perceived value and financial capability. So as a potential target market emerges from thinking more about your passions, your knowledge, your interests, and talents, as well as a closer inventory of the people you know, the third factor to consider is the value of your writing to that potential target market or target markets that you're considering. In other words, how important is the type of writing you do to them? Is it important enough for them to compensate you well? Or do they treat copy and content as more of a commodity than an investment with a high potential return? Also, what's their financial capability to pay according to the value they see in your work? So in other words, if they see great value in your product, can they pay accordingly? So let me give you a quick example, and then we'll get to some specific indicators to look for when evaluating potential target market. And some of these examples are going to be kind of off the wall, but I want to kind of disrupt your thinking and let's take things way outside of industries you might be thinking about or potential target markets you might be thinking about, just so you see the point and you see where I'm going with this. So let's say that your neighbor teaches swimming classes for children at the local neighborhood pool every summer, and she does this for fun, for some extra money, and she might do only, let's say, four or five sets of lessons every season, each with no more than four kids. Lessons are $80 per child, so her total take each summer is somewhere around $1,000 to $1,500 per season, right? So $1,000 to $1,500 is all she'll make that summer. She comes to you because she wants to create a simple website to promote her lessons, and she wants to know what you charge to write the copy. Considering that her total profits from this venture are no more than $1,500 per year, how do you think she would react if you quoted her $750, right? Not great. That's half of her take. Now, let's switch that around a little bit. Let's say that she and her husband travel around the city all summer long doing swimming lessons in neighborhood pools around your city. And let's say you live in a city of 6-7 million people. It's a large city. Now they're bringing in $7,000 a month from, let's say, May through September. And then after the pool season's over, they hit indoor aquatic centers and gyms for the rest of the year. So they're working year round, and they bring an average of $4,000 a month on those cooler months. Okay, with that information, how would this impact their desire and ability to pay you well for the job, especially considering that most of their potential customers visit their website to learn more about their teaching approach before enrolling their children in one of their lessons? Here's another example. And let's now kind of get back into the business world. Say you come across a very specialized consulting firm that goes after large retailers around the world to help them save 20% or more on their energy costs across their stores. Let's say their typical client engagement runs anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million. And assuming they need a series of three white papers to help them market their services, how do you think they'd be willing to pay the right writer? Do you think they'd be willing to pay a writer that seems to be a good fit, let's say $3,000 to $5,000 per white paper? probably so. So, what are the markets for both perceived value in your work and a market's ability to pay well? All right. First, you'll want to consider the offerings. You know, that by offerings, I'm talking about the product, services, or solutions of the companies in that market. And ask yourself, okay, are the products, services, solutions, in other words, their offerings, are they new or different? Are they expensive? And by expensive, I'm talking about expensive for their typical customers. Because what sounds expensive to you might not be expensive to the target market that they're going after. And are they complex? So why these three factors? Well, because products, services, or solutions that are new or different, expensive, and or complex don't just sell themselves. They're often what are called considered purchases. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. Consider purchases that involve a formal buying process, several decision makers, and a lot of content from the vendor, content that someone needs to write, okay? That's why they're considered. It's not something somebody makes. It's a decision somebody makes instantaneously. It's not a decision that's made off the cuff. The other thing you're going to want to ask yourself is, do the market's typical offerings address an urgent or a very important need or desire for their own customers? And you can answer that by looking at the products or services that this potential client would sell to their customers. And if these offerings are tied to things such as revenue generation, profit improvement, risk mitigation, growth, their core mission, or a strong core desire or goal, then their offerings probably fall in the urgent or very important category. All right, so why is this important? Well, here again, when a business or organization needs to market something that solves an urgent or a very important problem for their own customers, they're going to be much more willing to invest in content and or copy to help market or sell those offerings. All right, so I know that might sound a little fuzzy, so let's go back to the earlier example, and I think that's going to make it clear. Let's look at the example of the individual swim instructor doing this more as a hobby than as a business. So ask yourself, are her services new, expensive, or complex? No. All right, what about urgency? Does she help fulfill an urgent or a very important need for her potential customers? Yeah, maybe. In most cases, parents will consider these lessons to be very important, but I don't know if they think of them as urgent. Okay, so you have many factors pointing to a low level of financial value or financial capability, which doesn't really bode well for you. All right, let's take the second scenario, the one with the husband and wife team. So now it's not just the wife doing this. It's a team. They're a little more serious. It's a business. And here again, their offerings are not new. They're not expensive. They're not complex. But what if instead of kind of the standard run-of-the-mill swimming lessons, what if they used a proprietary proven system to teach older kids who are non-swimmers how to banish their fear of water and develop competence by the second session, by the second lesson? Well, that might fall under the new or innovative category, right? Kind of high on that category. And if the lessons are expensive, that's another plus for you, that is, right? Also, what if they market to parents who have spent years trying many different swim schools or camps with little to no success? And what if the child is now entering an age where it gets harder to learn to swim without being overly fearful? So here again, what you have is a lot of factors pointing towards higher value, which makes them better candidates from a financial standpoint alone. By better candidates, I'm talking about candidates for you to a person with your writing services. And by the way, notice that these folks are actually defining a specific target market for themselves in the example I just gave you, right? So they're very specific in this example about who they really target, who they best serve. So this changes things, and it puts them in a place where they might be a more viable prospect for you based on those factors. Let's take the other example, the one with the consulting firm that helps retailers reduce their energy costs, because the factors are a little more clear cut there. Okay, so their offerings are probably new or innovative, right? They're definitely expensive. We established that, $500,000 to $1 million per engagement on average, and their approach is probably complex enough that it needs to be explained. So does it solve an urgent or very important need for their customers? Absolutely. Okay, so this example scores very high in the financial value and the financial capability area of choosing a target market. You see how that works? All right. Let's look at the last area here that you need to consider. And it's important that you consider this one because it's about the personal client attributes. And this one's kind of a soft area, but it is important. And I need to mention it and you need to consider it. Now, I'm sure you'll agree that this business is much more fun when you work with people who not only value your work, but who also respect you as a person. You know, they're fun to work with, they jive with your personality, and they make the work experience that much better, even when the pay is not as good as it might be with other clients. The ideal target market for you is one where all those factors meet. Okay, it's one where you get to write about topics that interest you, where clients don't take much work to close because you're able to leverage relationships or word of mouth marketing, that sort of thing, and where they value your work, the work you do, and are willing to pay well for it. And finally, where the people you work with are a real joy, that they're fun, they value you, they respect you. In a perfect world, you'd be able to find the intersection of all four of these factors quickly and easily. And while that does happen occasionally, most freelancers use this more as a guide than as a go or no-go litmus test. So what I mean by that is there's actually a sweet spot you can focus on that includes, but is not limited by, the bullseye, if you will. And the key is to pick a target market that's somewhere in that sweet spot. In reality, the sweet spot is moldable and can bend in any direction that carries the most weight for you. So for instance, say that working with clients who have the right personal client attributes is super important to you, much more so than their willingness or capability to pay high fees for your work. Well, because you'd rather work with people who are fun, who are passionate, and that are driven by something you admire, and that's more important than making a higher income. In that case, your sweet spot will be skewed in that direction, as it should. And I'm not saying that not making a high income is not a priority, but you've placed a greater weight on the personal attributes of the clients you work with. So therefore, your sweet spot kind of bends a little bit more in that direction. And again, I'm not suggesting these are mutually exclusive attributes. I'm merely saying that you should give some thought to how you would choose when faced with competing attributes. We're going to revisit that sweet spot idea later. In the meantime, let's go ahead and wrap up this lesson, and we'll continue in the second part of this audio tutorial where we'll go through a detailed exercise that will help you uncover the sweet spot for you.